Welcome to the College Commons Podcast, passionate perspectives from Judaism's leading thinkers, brought to you by HUC Connect, the Hebrew Union College's online platform for continuing education. I'm Joshua Holo, your host. Welcome to this episode of the College Commons Podcast, and I am delighted to introduce my colleague and friend, Judah M. Cohen. Over the course of four books and over 50 articles, Judah M. Cohen has explored the idea of Jewish cultural expression as a dynamic and ever-changing process. His remarkably wide-ranging research interests include music and Jewish life, American music, musical theater, popular culture, Caribbean Jewish history, diaspora, and medical ethnomusicology. And with all that, he also serves as the Jack, Joseph, and Morton Mandel Provost of the Hebrew Union College. One of those four books is titled The Making of a Reform Jewish Cantor. And in honor of the 150th anniversary of the Hebrew Union College, Dr. Cohen and I will discuss Jewish music, its history, power, and the role of the Hebrew Union College in promoting it. Judah Cohen, my friend Judah, welcome to the College Commons Podcast.
Josh, it's so great to be here, and it's wonderful to be talking with you.
So before we get into the business side of this conversation, I want you to wax philosophical for me just for a moment. What is music's unique power to ignite the soul?
Great question. From one perspective, I would say that music is like any other expressive form. It allows people to take the meanings that they see around them and the way that they wish to express themselves, their identities, and gives them a way to do so that doesn't require the constrictive nature of words, of sentences, of grammar. People can create a variety of different grammars through music. And even more so, to me, I find that music is something that allows for multiple modes of communication simultaneously. What's powerful then is the sense that music, in fact, can communicate a really huge amount of information without necessarily speaking a word. And yet music is also fully compatible with words, with sounds, and with the ability to communicate in a more verbal way, or at least one that's associated with text.
And it's also compatible with formal religious expression in synagogues, churches, and mosques, and every religion the world over. Mm-hmm. So we're going to dive into that in the context of Reform Judaism. And we're going to start with some prehistory before the institutionalized academic version of what we call today cantorial school. Who was in charge, for lack of a better term, of Jewish music in America?
It's a really good question, and it's one that I've been trying to explore by going through layer upon layer upon layer. From one perspective, you could say that throughout this time period in the U.S., Jewish music or synagogue music or music connected with Jews in some way or another actually has always had a professional nature to it. There's always been some kind of a place that you could go to study music formally, or some kind of set of teachers or a teacher that you could study with that would bring you through a kind of a method. From that method, you would then develop a technique, you'd develop nuance, you'd be able to start working with what comes down to you as a sense of tradition, and then you'd be able to work your way into leadership positions in synagogues, in communities, and sometimes within the broader social environment in which Jewish populations lived.
Against that backdrop, when was it that HUC and the Jewish Theological Seminary, also called JTS, decided to invest in formal graduate academic programs in cantorial studies and certification?
A really interesting question here, because from one perspective, we can go back even further to the late 19th century and into the early 20th century and see that the Jewish institutions invested in music really from very early on. The question of what it means to move from the study of music into the development of cantorial programs is a really interesting transition that really started sometime around the early part of the 20th century and eventually moved its way into an institutional program at Hebrew Union College in 1948, at the Jewish Theological Seminary in 1952, and connected with what we now call Yeshiva University in 1954. In each of these cases, what I find so interesting is that they all have a common origin. That is, there were a group of scholars and a group of practitioners and a group of musicians and people that served as musical leaders or as leaders in congregations who had a strong sense of a need for musical leadership, who came together and created a series of societies to try and improve the musical quality of the synagogue, or to improve the leadership and to train the leadership so that they could create or continue to promote a specialized role for music through a figure that eventually became known as the cantor. From those organizations came the impetus to establish schools of music. And those schools of music, one after the next, initially the idea was supposed to be that there would be one school of music. And then, as we see with many of these kinds of institutional connections, each institution connected to each form of Judaism found themselves to be the folks who wanted to create the core of that musical tradition, or to teach the core of that musical tradition. And each one thus developed their own program in parallel from the same origin.
I can understand musically the desire to up a certain kind of quality and why certain styles of formalizing education can advance that. But from the perspective of the Hebrew Union College, what were the institutions aiming for when they decided to build, at presumably some cost, these programs? Did they sense a demand for middle-class styled professionalism for suburban synagogues that were mushrooming up in mid-century America? Did they associate graduate programs with prestige or legitimacy? Or maybe were they hoping to spur creativity against the risk of some kind of imagined traditionalist or pietistic stagnation?
I think it's a combination of all of those things, plus a couple of others. As my research tended to lead me, I saw a couple of key stated reasons at the opening of these schools. Among them, the sense of loss that was connected with the Holocaust and with the communities that were lost there. In a sense, music was perceived as being more developed, and the cantorate in particular was more developed in Central and Eastern Europe. And many of the star cantors from the previous several decades were from parts of Eastern Europe and were seen as representatives of a deep sense of Jewish traditional life. Once those areas were obliterated, by the Nazis, then there was the question that was not just in music, but of course across the board, of how the United States, as the place that had now the largest Jewish populations in the world, could try to start to rebuild a deep sense of culture and a deep sense of Jewish identity. From that perspective, when the School of Sacred Music opened at Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion, in 1948, one of the clear stated reasons was to restart or to be able to revitalize Jewish music in America now that the United States was the place where Jews had the largest core population.
So I get all of those reasons, which makes sense to me. But I want to go back to the parallel development across the ideological spectrum of Judaism that resulted in three legacy seminaries investing in three cantorial schools, or the equivalents of cantorial schools. Was there back then the perception that many people have today that questions the necessity for different cantorial schools, even if one acknowledges the necessity of different rabbinical schools from an ideological perspective.
You ask a really, really good question. I think the ideological perspectives were what spurred on each of the cantorial schools or each of the schools of Jewish music or departments of Jewish music, depending upon which institution you're describing. There was something meaningful to each one of these schools to say that we are the ones to train for Jewish music in its broadest form. And yet, each one also brought their own take on what the center of Jewish music was supposed to sound like. So, from one perspective, if you were to look at Hebrew Union College, you would see in that school of sacred music a desire to train not just cantors, but also organists and choir leaders, for example, and also to develop into parallel tracks what has become known over time as a traditional track connected to what we see as the music and the presentation of the great cantorial tradition. And also an art music track that's now or has been called the reform track, which tends to focus on formats connected with organ and choir and cantor.
So there's a
So,
creative impulse there, which corresponds to some movemental.
yes, very much so. And a desire to be able to take a hold of that sense of tradition and to then empower both the instructors and the students to really start to create in those traditions as well, to be able to innovate, to be able to propagate, to be able to serve those communities, in this particular case, the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, that would then share an aesthetic.
The College Commons podcast belongs to HUC Connect, the online platform for continuing education from the Hebrew Union College. HUC Connect includes webinars, syllabi for community learning, and masterclasses for HUC alumni, with interviews, expert panels, and classroom materials on topics ranging from the arts to civil society, Israel, and much more. Check us out at huc.edu/HUC Connect. Now, back to our interview.
So let's shift from the college's needs and interests to the needs and interests of the young students who would become cantors by enrolling in the program. What internal needs do they fulfill of their own in pursuing an institutionalized, diploma-driven, academic course of study, as far as you were able to determine in your research?
Well, let me start by saying that many of the people who initially came to the School of Sacred Music had already been involved in Jewish musical leadership coming in. In fact, there was a provision for life experience as a way to bring in additional credits or to accelerate one's status within the School of Sacred Music. So you actually hit the nail on the head in a certain way in recognizing that the formalizing of that training and the awarding of a degree upon completion of that training, the taking of classes, the studying with masters in the field, all of those combined with a sense that academic study provided a certain level of prestige within liberal Jewish communities and the Reform community quite specifically, allowed for the development of the cantorate as a professional degree, and a professional degree that would stand alongside the rabbinical study approach as well, which similarly was scientific, was based on a clear sense of what scholarship and academic study looked like, and also culminated in a degree.
And is also not unique to the Reform movement, but very characteristic of the Reform movement.
Very much.
So you introduce a term in your book called musical authority. Break down that idea for us Philistines out here. What is musical authority? It seems like such a complicated and interesting idea. And I want to ask you to break down the idea by distinguishing what the term means in a religious context as contrasted to what the idea of musical authority might mean in a non-religious context.
In its most basic form, and I would say looking at both religious and non-religious context, musical authority makes reference to the idea that individuals are considered to be key figures that people look to as both musicians and as innovators within the context of a larger society. How do you achieve that authority? Well, as we would with any kind of a skill or any kind of a major or something of that sort, that one develops that authority by taking a course of study, often a progressive course of study, and from there emerging, having had a significant amount of experience, as someone that others can look to for leadership. So, in the case of musical authority outside of the religious world, musical authority could mean the person that you look to give you piano lessons, or to allow for the person that you want to hire for some kind of an event, or a person whose music you think is fantastic and whose albums you're going to buy. From a religious perspective, this also means someone who you would be willing to invest in as some kind of a leader in a synagogue or in some kind of a religious environment, and be able to endow, or at least be able to recognize, with a certain level of spiritual attainment. Someone who is convincing when they're doing a prayer that you wish to see as prayerful.
So the convincing part's important. If you're a Jew in the pew and you're a skeptic and you think, musical authority, schmauthority. If I like the person singing and it moves my kishkas to be close to God, I don't care if they got a cantorial degree or not. And maybe they do or maybe they don't. But how would you express to that person that they may be getting the benefit of a kind of education and a kind of musical authority, even if they don't think they are, or if they're not aware of the fact that they are?
One of the things that authority comes with is a sense of provenance or a sense of background. So the question then looks to background, to training, to what someone has experienced, and to how they have practiced music over the course of their lifetime to determine for any individual or for any community whether or not they are seen as a musical representative of that community, worthy to express with them and for them and to teach them as well.
Perhaps in a Jewish context, as a civilization and a religion, which is so connected to the depth of its tradition, is it fair to throw in the idea of authenticity in there as well?
Yes. And to think about it as an idea, not as a truth necessarily, because different people see authenticity in very different ways, but to be able to allow for narratives of history and sound to merge together into an experience that will allow someone to feel that they're having a meaningful moment within a religious ritual or a sound that will lead them into that ritual.
So, educationally speaking, you point out that some of the key faculty in the cantorial school, when you were researching at the cantorial school, which is roughly the turn of the millennium, had themselves learned the cantorial arts, what you call, quote, the old way. But these same people, they accepted that they had to teach in the new way. And even other faculty, as you describe it, who were products of the proverbial new way, even they tried to articulate the value of learning from person to person in some kind of oral tradition. And even these younger generation cantorial professors, they didn't want our students learning just from a book. So, what was gained and what was lost in managing the transition from the old way of learning to be a cantor to the new one?
So let me start by identifying that terms like old way and new way, like many of the other terms in the book, were ones that I tried to bring in based on the way that I had heard cantorial students and cantorial teachers speak. So terms like that, I tried to see and introduce as a way to say, here's the way that they're looking at these different kinds of approaches to pedagogy. So from one perspective, the old way was perceived as a moment, or at least as a historical time, in which the transmission of cantorial tradition happened from a master to an apprentice and happened in ways that were perceived as not as formalized. Whereas the new way looked to the old way to try to recognize what was passed down and then turned it into the equivalent of a curriculum, with the idea that a curriculum was treated as a response to modernity, if you'll excuse me for saying so, and to be able to quote the title of another fantastic book by Michael Meyer about the history of Reform Judaism. In this case, the sense then of saying that young people can no longer grow up with the old way, and so the new way must best approximate what that old way or how that old way was understood. What that means then is that people or the students in these classes were able to both connect to a long sense of history, to be able to connect to a deep concept of Judaism that had a longer past than just the past couple hundred years, and at the same time, to become fluent in expressing that tradition in a modern context.
As a Jew in the pew, not as an academic, not as an observer, not as a singer yourself, share with us a moment of experiencing Jewish music that transformed you, and tell us what happened to you when you heard whatever it is that you heard.
Wow. As a Jew in the pew, a key transformative moment for me was when I was very young on Shabbat morning with one of my earliest cantors. His name was Cantor Morris Levinson at Temple Beth El in South Orange, New Jersey. I don't recall a specific moment, but what I do recall is a mature man standing on the bima and singing and delivering prayer in a style that struck me week over week as traditionally Jewish, as if I wanted to hear Jewish music, this is what it would sound like. I also saw that there was a certain formality to Cantor Levinson, and that then reflected upon the music and the sound itself as well. And so it led to a certain, I think what Benji Schiller has described as a kind of a majesty to the music too. You know, at that point, I didn't have a clear sense of what Jewish music history was, but I didn't need to. What I needed to do was to experience a service, and to experience that service as something that was not just meaningful, but that also helped to instill in me a sense of tradition. That's what Cantor Levinson's presence did for me. I've had the great honor and pleasure of being in congregations for many, many other cantors since. And, you know, for me, each time I have the opportunity to continue to grow and deepen my sense of what Jewish tradition is and my sense of what sound does when it comes to understanding Jewish history and its incredible nuance over the course of many years.
Well, now's your opportunity to share directly with us, because I'm going to ask you to take us out of this interview by singing your favorite version of Adon Olam.
So I'll start by saying that Adon Olam is itself so compatible with so many different tunes, in part because the poetic rhythm itself of the text is so uniform. So in fact, it is eight syllables, eight syllables, eight syllables, eight syllables. And because of that, so many different things can work to it. So for me, the one that immediately comes to mind is
All right, we got duet going. Thank you, Judah Cohen, for the pleasure of the conversation and joining us on the
Honey.
College Commons podcast.
Thank you so much, Josh. It's been a pleasure.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the College Commons Podcast, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. And check out HUC Connect, compelling conversations at the forefront of Jewish learning. For more information about all that HUC Connect has to offer, visit huc.edu/HUC Connect.